squelched under his shoes.
"Spread out!" someone behind them called.
Something clattered just ahead. Silently, Storm placed Fowler's hand on a turnstile. Then he both heard and felt her clamor over it. He followed as their pursuers shouted to each other and rushed toward the sounds. Clear of the turnstile, Fowler waved his hand around until it bumped Storm's and she gripped his again. They moved quickly along the wall, their pursuers not 20 feet behind. It sounded like they were a dozen or more. "Steps," Storm whispered as she drew him down. Clutching a handrail, they scrambled lower, the darkness growing thicker and damper. At the bottom, they again moved along the wall until Storm whispered, "Jump!" And Fowler felt the edge of the platform and sprang blindly, landing on gravel in a 3-point stance. Storm pulled him to the right, although he was sure she'd told him to go left. They ran, holding hands. Fowler held his free hand out in front of his face, praying they didn't run headlong into a train sitting on the track. The crunching of their feet on the gravel was mostly drowned by the shouts passing among their pursuers. After only a few dozen yards, Storm squeezed his hand hard and drew him to the wall. When she pushed him down, Fowler grasped her plan. He crouched against the wall, trying to make himself as small as possible, then heard Storm moving in the gravel and realized she was doing him one better, lying on her side, right along the bottom of the wall. He did the same, her feet pressing against his head. Their pursuers were smart. They had spread out to cover the entire tunnel, and as they approached, Fowler exhaled, willing himself to melt into the wall. A foot brushed his cheek. He tensed, anticipating a shout, rough hands reaching for him, but the phalanx forged on down the tunnel, their voices growing dimmer. Fowler rose to his haunches, felt Storm do the same. Closing her hand over his, Storm silently led him back the way they had come. Chapter 8. Her lips were still warm. If Ugo had walked into the lab at that moment, found Peter's mouth on Isabella's as she lay naked on the gurney, what would he think? "Oh, God, Isabella!" He squeezed her hand. "Please, please, come back!" Peter had told her he wouldn't let anything happen to her. Then he remembered her duplicate. He hadn't checked her duplicate. He rushed over, turned her face up, searched for a pulse in her still warm neck. Nothing. She was dead. Peter lifted his face toward the ceiling and screamed. What had he been thinking? He should have said no. No matter how hard she persisted, he should have said no. He pulled his phone from his pocket to call an ambulance, opened his contact list, searching for the number for emergencies. The number wasn't under E for emergency. He scrolled down to the end of the list, past Wolkoff, Ugo, and froze. He should call Ugo first. He owed it to Ugo to tell him himself. He punched Ugo's number. "What do you want?" Ugo said by way of greeting. "It's Isabella. She's gone, Ugo. She's dead." Ugo stammered. "My Bella? How can that be? I would have been contacted." "No, she's not at the hospital. She checked herself out."
"What? Why?"
Peter swallowed, trying to wet his dry mouth. "She asked me to duplicate her. She... it didn't work." Ugo howled into the phone. Peter squeezed his eyes shut, resisted the urge to pull the phone away from his ear. He tried to say he was sorry, but Ugo cut him off.
"Don't touch her, you son of a bitch!"
He disconnected. It didn't seem possible for Ugo to arrive as quickly as he did. He burst through the door.
"Isabella!"
He dropped to her side, across from Peter, lifted her hand and squeezed it in both of his. His entire body was shaking. Isabella's mouth was partially open from Peter's useless attempt at CPR, her lips curled back in a grimace or a smile, displaying her even white teeth. She should be breathing. Why wasn't she breathing? "I'm so sorry, Ugo. You have no idea." Bella kept asking.
"Shut up!" Ugo screamed. "Don't you dare try to blame my Bella. Don't you dare! You did this!"
"I did. Because she wanted me to. It was a chance, at least." Peter didn't see the punch coming. It felt like a mallet smashing into his nose. He fell back, cracked his head on the hard floor.
I was her chance!
Ugo stood over him, his breath coming in huge, ragged gasps.
My research was her chance!
He poked his chest.
I was going to save her, not you!
Peter felt blood dribbling between his fingers as he clutched his nose. If you want to bring me up on charges. I understand.
Charges?
Ugo shook his head in disbelief.
I'll fucking kill you!
He turned back to Isabella, knelt, and pressed his fingers to her cheek. She hadn't had many good days left. The rest of her life would have been torture. Surely Ugo could see that. Ugo slid his arms beneath Isabella's legs and shoulders and lifted her. What are you doing? Peter asked, sitting up. You shouldn't move her.
Shut up! My wife is not going to be remembered as the victim of some sick experiment. She died peacefully in her own bed.
Ugo shifted Isabella's body, trying to get a better grip. He studied her face.
You're sure I have my wife, not the abortion you made?
Yes. Ugo headed for the door. What should I do with this one? Peter called.
I couldn't care less.
Ugo pushed the door open with his shoulder and headed for the parking lot. Grasping the edge of a lab table, Peter struggled to his feet. A few drops of blood dribbled to the floor. He pinched his nose to stop the flow. The duplicate Isabella lay pale and silent under the fluorescent lights. If Ugo wanted people to believe Isabella died of the disease, this Isabella had to disappear. Peter squeezed his eyes shut, trying to think of what to do. Nothing came. Isabella was gone. He'd killed her. That was all he could think of. He needed help. Harry. Peter pulled out his phone. Harry would help him figure out what to do. Chapter 19. Why don't invaders use these tunnels to cross under the walls? Fowler asked as they crept along. They're blocked off at the borders, Storm said. Things had developed so differently on this world. Walls and burrows, wars and dictators. Things had been a hell of a lot simpler on Fowler's world. The people had seemed simpler as well. The chatter of rats grew louder, along with a rancid stench, then it fell away as they moved past what must have been a side tunnel. Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm wondering how you ended up with a man like Moonlark. He wasn't always like this. Storm caught herself, paused. No, that's not true. There used to be more to him, is what I should say. He stood out in the early days when everyone was acting like animals. He helped me without asking for anything in return. He showed me respect when he didn't have to. Maybe it was the sense of anonymity the darkness created, or fatigue bringing her guard down, but Fowler felt like he knew Storm much better than he had a few minutes earlier. Did he trust her enough to show her the photo? It was in his back pocket. The darkness shifted from black to dark gray, and Storm slowed. I think this is our stop. They climbed onto the platform and skulked along the wall until dim light and a staircase became visible. They surfaced on a calm side street, but sounds of fighting were close. They were half a block from a weed-choked field that bordered one end of Moonlark's compound, and decided their safest bet was to push straight through the field. Fowler led the way, weaving through head-high weeds and brush until they emerged across the street from the gate. Dozens of men patrolled inside the compound's fence. As soon as someone spotted Storm and Fowler, they rushed them inside. Is Moonlark back? Storm asked as Hammer met them at the door.
No.
From his tone and expression, it was clear he didn't expect to see Moonlark again. He grasped Storm's elbow.
Listen to me. It's not just Uptown. Riverdale and Bordertown are coming from the other side. There's a breach in the wall between us and Bordertown. It's only a matter of time before Gateway falls.
Storm's reaction confirmed what Fowler already suspected. The news was a death sentence. They'd kill Storm immediately and string Fowler up as soon as it was clear he couldn't operate the weapons. There was nowhere they would be safe. At least, there was nowhere on this world They would be safe. Fowler reached for Storm's hand. Come on. Storm pulled her hand away. What do you mean, come on? Don't you get it? There's nowhere to run. Yes, there is. Fowler held up a finger. Wait there, don't move. He raced down the hall, slid the last 5 feet on the slick floor, and darted into his room. The parachute and his pack were bunched on the dresser with his jumpsuit. We need food and water, he said to Storm as he raced past her toward the kitchen. Wait a minute, she called after him. In the kitchen, he filled 2 empty glass jugs with screw-on caps from a trough of water under the window, grabbed a loaf of bread from the counter, slabs of cured meat from the pantry, 6 apples. Storm appeared in the kitchen doorway. Where are you suggesting we go? She said it a word at a time. The only direction left, Fowler pointed at the floor. Down. If there are 2 worlds, why not 3? Or 100? He shrugged on his pack while Storm laughed dryly. You've got to be kidding. I'd rather take my chances with the invaders. Fowler stopped, looked intently at Storm. Would you, really? I'm not jumping off the edge. She made a slashing motion with her hand. Forget it. Even with your little parachute stunt, I'm not sure I believe your insane story. Even if I did, there's no way. Fowler pulled the photo from his pocket and handed it to Storm. She studied it, her expression melting from bemused to serious and finally to shock. Where did you get this? I found it in my pocket on day one. Day one? Day one, when time began. Her usually pale skin was alabaster. She studied the picture, shaking her head in astonishment. We look like lovers. She looked up from the photo, studied Fowler's face carefully. What is this? I was hoping you'd know. Storm brought the photo close to her face. Let me ask you something, Fowler said. In those early days, people discovered a lot of photos of themselves, with people they didn't know, in places that didn't exist. Did you find any pictures of yourself? She looked at him as if he'd performed a magic trick. No. How would you know that? He tapped the photo. This is the only picture of me. It's as if I'd just arrived there on day one while everyone else had been there a while. Storm turned the photo over and examined the back, as if she suspected it might be 2 photos cleverly joined together. I really did fall from another world. When Storm didn't respond, Paula reached out and clutched her hand, squeezed it. Storm, I'm not joking. I'm not insane. I'm not full of shit. I fell. Here. Her eyes flicked across his face, then back to the photo. Why are you showing me this now? I didn't show it to you before because I didn't want Moonlark to cut my throat. Storm laughed. Wise move. But why are you showing it to me now? Did he need to spell it out for her? The photo said they should be together. So you'll trust me, Fowler said. She handed back the photo. Why should I trust you? You just admitted it yourself. You have no idea if there are more worlds below this one. You're just guessing. I'm not jumping off the edge of the world on a guess. It's an educated guess. He returned the photo to his pocket, tucking it beside the blood sketch. It makes sense that there should be... The blood sketch appeared in his mind's eye, ovals, set one above the other. Only in Fowler's mind, his world, as it had looked after he fell off it, was superimposed over the top oval. Fowler? Fowler pulled the sketch from his pocket, flattened it on the kitchen counter. His heart racing, he examined the sketch with fresh eyes, the eyes of someone who has seen worlds from a distance. What is that? It's a map, he whispered. His fingers brushed the top oval, the one with a bloody thumbprint over it. Fowler had assumed the thumbprint was a careless smudge, but now he saw it for what it was, a marker. You are here. And the X on the lowest oval. X marks the spot, the part of his mind that supplied the words offered up. He had to reach that bottom world. Whatever it took, he had to get there. That was where the answers were. He looked at Storm. I'm not guessing. There are more worlds below this one, and I have to reach the bottom one. He tapped the map. On day one, I found this in my pocket, along with your picture. Look at it. It's a map. It's not a map, Storm said, frowning. It's a bunch of ovals. It's a map. I know how my mind works. He held up his left thumb, the one he'd cut to draw the map. I drew it with my own blood so I'd know how important it was that I take it seriously, that I figure it out and reach that bottom world. I left it in my pocket beside a picture of you, of us, because I was supposed to find you on the way. Paula lifted her hand, laced his fingers into hers. Tell me that doesn't feel right to you, he whispered. Tell me it doesn't feel as if our hands are grooved to fit together because they've spent so much time like this. Storm disengaged their hands, drew hers away. Trust me. Outside, the shouting had grown noticeably louder. I don't even know you, she shot back. And even if I did, you only have one parachute. We can share it. Look, Storm, at the risk of being blunt, you don't have many options. If you stay here, they're going to kill you. With me, at least, you have a chance. She reached into his vest, drew out the photo. She seemed to be studying her own face, perhaps marveling over how happy she looked. Fuller guessed that since day one she'd never once smiled like that. She offered him the photo, but when he grasped it, she held on. You're sure we can both land with just one parachute? Fuller nodded emphatically, yes. At least he thought they could. He'd figure out the details later. Are you sure there's another world below us? Yes. She let go of the photo. We'll need a torch. Chapter 9. The church came into view at the top of the hill. Peter looked away, wishing it were still 100 miles away or 10,000. Isabella and Melissa's Uncle Walt and Aunt Rose were on the sidewalk out front, heading for the big front doors wearing a black suit, a black dress. There was no way he could do this. He would feign illness, drop Melissa off and go home and get into bed. He wouldn't have to feign illness. He was nauseous, sweating, his bowels roiling at the thought of going in there and facing Ugo and Isabella's family and friends. Beside him, Melissa was hollow-eyed from lack of sleep, the ridges of her nostrils pink from blowing. He should tell her. If Melissa knew and was still willing to stand at his side through this funeral, Peter thought he could make it through. But each time he tried, the words choked him. When he'd wheeled Bella into the lab, he'd felt like he was doing a noble thing. Now it felt unspeakable. Melissa parked behind the church. The van's engine went silent. They sat staring through the windshield at the back of the church, the mourners silently filing around to the front, their heads bowed, many of the younger ones recent draftees in dress uniforms. Finally, Melissa opened her door, and Peter had no choice but to open his and follow her toward the church. Melissa reached out, took his hand, and he started to cry. She squeezed, thinking he was crying simply because Isabella was gone. He was crying because she was gone, but it was so much more than that. Ugo was standing just inside the doorway, for once hatless, accepting condolences. Melissa fell into his arms. They hugged fiercely for a long moment. Ugo's eyes squeezed shut, the veins in his temples bulging. When they finally broke off, Peter stepped up to Ugo, his legs shaking so badly he was sure he'd crumple. He held out his hand. I'm sorry, he managed. Ugo turned to the next mourner in line as if he hadn't seen Peter. Peter closed his hand, turned away. Melissa was gaping. My God, he just ignored you. Why would Ugo do that? Maybe he didn't see me. He looks like he's in a daze. He saw you. Could this still be about the Nobel? Surely he wouldn't turn his back on family over something like that. Not at a time like this.
I don't know what it's about.
As he uttered the lie, he was back beneath the lab, carrying Isabella's duplicate through the chilly darkness of the old factory with Harry. He'd hidden the body like a criminal. He flinched as a hand touched his back. It was Harry.
How are you holding up?
He lingered in Ugo's downstairs bathroom as long as he thought he could. As he stepped out, Bill and Audrey De Niro surrounded him.
We're so sorry for your loss. Audrey pressed her cheek to Peter's, the odor of Noxzema wafting from her.
Thank you.
Ugo appeared around the corner. He waited there as Bill clutched Peter's hand. When they were gone, Peter and Ugo had the hall to themselves.
I understand that you had no choice in coming here. Nothing could have kept me from coming.
I loved Isabella like a blood sister.
Ugo raised a finger, cutting him short.
He stepped in very close to Peter. Don't ever speak her name to me again. If I had my preference, you'd never speak to me again, period. Just stay away. If we have to be in the same room together, stay on the other side. Do you understand me?
Peter nodded. He didn't want to be around Ugo any more than Ugo wanted to be around him. If not for being tied to him through family and work, Peter would do everything in his power to never see Ugo again. Now that Isabella's funeral was behind him, all he wanted to do was work. To forget that night, to devote himself to helping people suffering from these bloody bioengineered diseases, and hope in time he would feel as if he'd done enough to balance the scales.
Chapter 20.
As they drew closer to the edge, no sounds drifted down from the streets. Evidently, the fighting was concentrated inland.
So who was the woman you thought you saw in the crowd? Storm asked as they picked their way through the subway tunnel, the torch providing a circle of black-orange light around them.
A friend in my world. Part of my tribe. Her name was Orchid.
Just a friend? Did you have someone special on your world?
I did. Someone I loved with all my heart.
Fuller grinned as Storm tried to mask her surprise.
Her name was Daisy. She was about 4 feet tall.
About your height, then?
Fuller laughed.
That's right.
I adopted her as a daughter, during the Purge.
The Purge?
When it became clear there wasn't enough food for everyone, and a band of men began throwing the weak over the edge. They killed thousands. Everyone who couldn't fight back. I wanted to stop them, but how could I? Then it occurred to me I could save one, at least. I ran up to a child at random, waving the photo of the two of us, shouting that it was a picture of me and that child. Some of the suspicion had melted from Storm's eyes.
You're just full of surprises.
Fuller hadn't meant to tell the story to win points with Storm. Daisy deserved better than to be used as a ploy for sympathy. I did it for myself, more than anything. If I hadn't saved at least one, I knew I'd feel sick with guilt for the rest of my life.
Those men throwing children off the edge were also doing it for themselves. They were worried about their stomachs. You were worried about your conscience.
The thing about it was, most of those men, they were crying, sobbing. But they just kept on.
Fowler choked up.
He didn't want to return to that day. Up ahead, a sliver of light announced the next station.
That's the one we want, Storm picked up her pace. It must be hard knowing Daisy is still up there, thinking you're dead.
I just hope the tribe is taking care of her. I'm sure they are. They're good people, especially Orchid, odd as she is.
Storm tossed the torch down the stairwell behind them as they emerged squinting into the sunlight at the edge of the world. The streets were deserted. The sky grew immense as they approached the edge. Fowler's heart thrummed at the thought of intentionally leaping off the edge of this world. Storm stopped well short of the edge, on chewed-up blacktop.
I don't think I can do this.
Fowler kept going. He peered over the edge, checking for obstructions. There were none. I faced this choice once before. Fall into the sky or die. It's not much of a choice,
if you think about it like that. He turned to face Storm. I don't want to die. Beyond that, I need to see what's at the bottom. I drew that map for a reason.
Storm eyed the edge like it was a poisonous snake. Ever since day one, we've lived with nothing but questions, Fowler said. Wouldn't you like some answers for a change? He held out his hand.
She studied him for a long moment, then reached out and took his hand.
Storm! Over Storm's shoulder, Fowler saw four men pushing a hollowed-out car, a fifth man steering. The fifth man was Moonlark. The car bumped and rattled toward them over ruptured pavement. Storm!
This time Storm heard Moonlark. She turned, gasped at the sight of him, alive but clearly injured.
Fowler squeezed her hand. If you go to him, you'll die with him. You said it yourself. There's nowhere to hide.
Fowler's heart hammered as Moonlark grew closer and Storm wavered, uncertain.
Wait! Moonlark was close enough now that he didn't have to shout. It was the same word the doomed man with the shovel had used.
Storm tried to unclasp her hand from Fowler's. If he let go, he knew he'd lose her.
He grabbed Storm's wrist with his free hand and pulled. Startled, Storm pulled in the opposite direction. No!
Fowler pulled, Storm dropped to her knees, then stretched full out, raking at his fingers with her free hand, screaming,
You'll die!
Fowler's back foot found nothing but empty space. He let himself fall backward, a death grip on Storm's wrist. Storm scrabbled to grab something with her free hand, digging at chunks of pavement, clutching at weeds that pulled free. Fowler's momentum dragged them over the edge. As they plummeted past outcroppings of stone, Moonlark appeared above them, limping, one leg bloody. He shouted something Fowler couldn't hear over Storm's terrified shrieks, then raised his arm. Gunshots rang out, 3, 4, 5, 6, each dimmer, less pressing than the last, until Moonlark was nothing but a blur of bloody charcoal suit on a backdrop of powder blue sky. Fowler felt a lash across his face. His first crazy thought was that one of the bullets had hit its mark far later than seemed possible. Then he realized Storm had hit him. She seemed less angry than panicked, a drowning woman reaching wildly for a branch.
We're okay. He tried to secure her flailing, free hand, but it swung wildly, matching the panic in her eyes.
She seemed lost in her terror, completely unaware of him, every muscle tensed, as if she were bracing for impact. Still clutching her hand, Fowler gripped her shoulder.
Storm, look at me! Look at me!
Her gaze flicked across his face for an instant, before returning to the sky underfoot.
We're okay. There's nothing to be afraid of.
Chapter 10. As the front door to the lab swung open, a jolt of adrenaline shot through Peter. It was Andrew Stone, one of the graduate students from UVA, looking bleary-eyed, probably here to gain access to a piece of equipment that wasn't available during the day. Peter gave him a salute. Andrew returned it. Ugo hadn't been to work in a week, not since before Isabella's funeral. Yet a jolt of terror went through Peter every time the door opened, day or night. Ugo had to return eventually. One time the door would open and it would be Ugo storming in.
Are we really going to do this?
He hadn't noticed Harry standing in his doorway. Peter set his bottle of Zing on the desk, pushed his wheeled chair away from the bank of computers that surrounded him on three sides.
Why not? How often do you get to see how the fabric of reality reacts when you stick a whoopee cushion under it?
I hadn't realized that's what we were doing. Although they weren't talking about her, the body of Isabella's duplicate might as well be hanging in the air between them. Peter felt it whenever they were together, and he was certain Harry did too, but Harry was too good a friend to bring it up. And Peter felt too ashamed. And what was there to say, really? The lab was deserted except for Andrew. They headed for the iris, Harry holding the tray containing the anesthetized mouse. With Ugo gone and the organ replication program stalled until the transplant team perfected their procedure, Peter was left with nothing to do but basic research. Most of the experiments they were conducting were aimed at understanding why Isabella had died, although only he and Harry understood that that was what they were doing. They now knew one crucial fact. No complex organism could survive the procedure if it was conscious when it went into the duplicator. Peter wanted to know more. He wanted to understand the duplicator inside and out,
Right now he wanted to see how it reacted if he gave reality a good hard shove. It was a wild experiment, best conducted in the middle of the night.
So what's your guess? Peter asked Harry.
Shit, I have no idea. If I had to guess, I'd say the mouse comes out duplicated as if the loop never happened.
Peter grinned. Fair enough. Peter was dying to see what would happen. It was like having an intimate conversation with the universe about how it worked.
Polchinski had first devised the physics version of the classic grandfather paradox. What happens if an object is sent through a wormhole and returns a millisecond earlier, but is sent back through the duplicator less than a millisecond later, and blocks itself so it can't enter in the first place? It creates a paradox.
Polchinski had used billiard balls in his thought experiment, but the paradox was no different when the objects were sleeping mice. To create the effect, they'd fashioned an additional delivery duct that fed directly back into the iris.
Peter went to the delivery duct on the left, where the original mouse would be delivered if it came back at all.
"Whenever you're ready," he called to Harry. "This is exciting."
"Here we go," Harry called back.
A shadow dropped out of the duct. Peter lurched backward. Harry shouted in surprise. It was not a shadow cast by an object. Certainly not the shadow of a mouse. It was darkness. The size of a tire. It blocked out the gray tile floor beneath without replacing it with anything but darkness so deep it created the illusion of a hole. The sight of it sent a wash of terror through Peter that bordered on superstitious dread, as if a demon or a god had dropped into his lab.
"Get Andrew out of here," he said to Harry.
Peter had no idea what it was, no idea if it was dangerous. It had just fallen out of a wormhole, and it absolutely should not have. So it was, by definition, dangerous. He turned, found Harry still staring at the thing transfixed.
"Now, get him out!"
As Harry jogged off, Peter circled the object. Nothing should be able to come out of the duplicator except objects they put in. It made absolutely no sense. The lab door opened and shut. Peter heard the lock click into place. 5 seconds later, Harry was back.
"What the hell is that?"
"I'm not sure."
"What if it's bathing us in radiation right now?"
Harry was standing a dozen feet farther back than Peter, as if that much extra distance would matter if the thing was doing them harm.
"If it is, it's probably too late."
It was three-dimensional. When he looked directly at it, it was difficult to see, as if his visual field were resisting it, trying to close up the blank space it created. Peter could see it better when he looked a few feet to one side. Then it solidified into a spherical object resting on the laboratory floor. No, not resting. The bottom of it was no longer perfectly spherical, it was flattened. The object was slowly sinking. There was a bluish glow where it was eating into the floor. It was ionizing the matter it was in contact with. Peter giggled. He clapped his hand over his mouth, tried to get hold of himself. He thought he might be in shock. Taking a deep breath, he tried to think. First, they had to neutralize this thing before it ate right through the floor. Peter turned to Harry. "We need to introduce something charged. Come on." Peter sprinted toward the Van de Graaff generator.
"Something charged?" Harry said.
He stood as if glued to the floor.
"Holy shit, you think it's a singularity?"
"Yeah, I do." He grabbed Harry by the arm and tugged him. "If we charge it, we can control it. Help me." They set the Van de Graaff generator near the black sphere.
"Find 2 metal plates somewhere,"
Peter said as the generator began to spark as it charged up. If the object wasn't a singularity, it was sure doing a fine job of reacting exactly as a singularity should. He ran to get a battery. Peter returned with 2 metal covers he'd torn off air conditioning ducts. They set the metal plates on either side of the object, attached the positive pole of the battery to one plate, the negative to the other. The object rose into the air until it was centered between the 2 plates. It was neutralized and suspended. Now they needed to get it out of the lab to somewhere secure and figure out what they were dealing with. In his underground explorations with Ugo, they'd often passed a huge factory room with a thick steel door. That room would do nicely. "Grab an end," Peter said, grasping one of the plates.
"Jesus,"
Harry breathed as he lifted the other plate. The object rose as if by magic.
"If this is a singularity, why isn't it heavy?" Harry asked.
Peter nodded. "A singularity with the circumference of a tire should weigh more than the Earth."
"Hell, don't ask me. The paradox must cause some unusual quantum effect. There's so much debate about what happens when quantum mechanics and singularities come together, the only thing that would be surprising is if the result didn't surprise us."
They stood gawking at the object hovering between them.
"What the hell did we do?" Peter asked. "Hey, don't look at me. I just work here," Harry said.
Peter smiled at him. "You practicing for when the feds find out?" They located a wheeled cart to carry the battery and Van de Graaff generator, then slowly moved it all toward the hall. The stairs are going to be a bitch. "Once we've designed a more professional electrostatic trap, let's start with a Geiger-Müller tube, alpha spectrometer, gamma and neutron detectors to see if we need to set up a quarantine and call in the feds. I don't want to call the feds if we don't have to. They're liable to shut us down and then sort it out."
Chapter 21. Storm's panic eventually subsided. What choice did she have? Your heart can only race for so long, as Fowler and everyone else had discovered in the weeks after day one. As she grew less panicked, she grew angrier.
"I couldn't let you die,"
Fowler had to shout to be heard over the wind.
"You have no idea if I was going to die. Maybe Moonhawk was coming to tell me they'd pushed back the invasion."
The constant pressure of the wind against her face made her look strange. Her cheeks stretched, skin rippling, eyes wide, in a look of perpetual surprise.
"The other burrows were pouring in from all sides. They were going to kill you. You'd be dead right now if you'd stayed. It doesn't matter. It wasn't your decision to make. But will you admit there was no conceivable way you could have survived if I'd left you there? Who the hell do you think you are? You think you can make decisions for me just because you have a picture of me? If I wanted to stay and die with Moonlark, you had no right to stop me." "He shot at us! He shot at you!"
Fowler took a deep breath, tried to speak as calmly as possible, although the need to shout made it difficult to sound calm.
"I'm sure he was primarily shooting at me, but you were right there, so he wasn't showing much concern for you. That's all I'm saying. If you care about someone, you don't shoot at something close to them. You dragged me over a cliff. Don't lecture me about right and wrong."
Fowler fell silent. She had a point. He'd acted instinctively because he'd had no time to do otherwise. It had seemed like the right thing to do in the moment. Even now, with time to think, he thought he'd done the right thing, but he had to admit an argument could be made that what he'd done was wrong.
"I'm sorry," he said,
and again it was hard to sound sincere while shouting. Storm didn't answer. Not sure what else to say to make things right, Fowler watched the sky. He followed the progress of a dozen dark, oblong clouds in an otherwise clear sky. They looked like fish swimming in an endless blue lake. Some on his world were convinced clouds were alive, that they ate sunlight and rain was their piss or their tears. Fowler was the only person in the worlds who knew clouds were nothing but misty air, though Storm would soon be in on the secret.
"Isn't it beautiful?" he finally asked. "What? The sky. Isn't it beautiful?"
She looked at him, apparently gauging whether he was serious. Then she shook her head in disbelief.
"You've got to be kidding me."
Soon after, they fell through a cloud and came out misty damp.
Chapter 22. It occurred to Fowler that he'd done nothing to address the issue of one chute and two falling bodies. He needed to be prepared when a world appeared. He reached for his pack. The simplest solution was to expand the harness so they could both squeeze into it, though when the chute opened, they'd be yanked together.
"Can you hold this tight?"
Fowler held out the folded-up chute and lines. Storm glared at him, then, careful not to let them blow out of her hands, she took them. After he'd been working for a while, Storm said, It wasn't the same person.
Paula looked at Storm, questioning. Moonlock spoke to the woman you thought you knew. She's never seen you before.
Paula grunted a laugh. Moonlock was thorough, that was for sure. Or he had been thorough.
Well, that answers that question.
What question is that? Whether you're delusional?
Very funny.
Paula wondered if she would ever forgive him. Whether she would leave him at the first opportunity.
Maybe when they found another world and landed safely, she'd realize he'd saved her life.
This ends Disc 4. Fowler, Disc 5.
Chapter 11.
Peter's heart leaped when Melissa was led into the lab by three members of his security team. She looked scared. Wait until she got a look at the thing in the basement. She ran ahead of the security people into Peter's arms.
I missed you,
Peter said into Melissa's hair. It had been 3 days since he'd seen her, and 4 days since he'd slept.
I was afraid you'd done something stupid and injured yourself.
Peter leaned back so he could see her eyes. But I wrote in my email, everyone is safe, no one's hurt, no one's in danger.
What else are you going to say?
She laughed.
I'm wounded and in terrible danger. More in a few days?
Peter put his hands on his hips.
Have I ever come across as one of those I didn't want to worry you guys? If I'm wounded, even if it's just a bad cut, I get slicing tomatoes in the kitchen. I want credit for my suffering. I want sympathy.
That I can't argue with. Remember when we had to prick our fingers in bio class to do that blood typing lab? I had to do it for you, and you carried on like I'd shot you.
I did not, Peter laughed. I didn't even flinch. I wanted to impress you with my bravery.
She grimaced. Hate to break this to you, but that ship sailed when you couldn't prick your own finger. Melissa looked around the almost empty lab.
So, what did happen?
Peter took her hand.
It's downstairs.
Your hand is all shaky and sweaty.
Melissa lifted their clasped hands.
Too much zing, not enough food.
Peter headed down the long hallway.
What have you been eating?
Peter shrugged.
Mostly pizza and Chinese.
I don't ever want to smell sweet and sour pork again. At the end of the hall, he flicked on the hastily installed lights in the stairwell, led Melissa down into a long abandoned locker room. Filthy orange rubber raincoats hung in a row along the wall like skins. Rustling came from one of the bathroom stalls lining the wall. A rat, probably.
Where are we going?
I wouldn't want to spoil the surprise. But I'll say this much. It's unbelievable. The world is never going to be the same.
This from a man who created a duplicator. Now my palms are sweating.
Down another concrete staircase where the air was danker, cooler. Through a largish room piled neck-high with World War II-era howitzer tires with a narrow trail through the center.
God, this is creepy.
We had to store it somewhere no one would ever look. Down another stairwell. At the bottom, Peter squatted to plug in two strings of Christmas lights. The long hallway glowed a ghostly blue and red. They reached the doorway, its heavy steel door swung open, leading onto the cavernous factory floor.
Hey, Melissa! Harry whisked toward them. Wish I could stay and watch your reaction, but your husband is running me like a 9-year-old in a sweatshop.
Peter tried to kick Harry's behind as he passed, but missed.
The factory floor was concrete, half the size of a football field. The foot-thick door suggested that back when this was a munitions factory, the room had been utilized for sensitive projects. Deep shadows hid the corners and ceiling. In the center was the isolation tank. 8 cubic feet of space, surrounded by a thick layer of military-grade blast-proof glass. Peter's hand-picked team, 4 physicists he both respected and trusted, were working around instruments set on tables they'd lugged down from the lab on the first day. Melissa went straight to the glass, peered in, then jerked away like she'd been stung.
What is that?
No matter how many times Peter looked at the thing, it never failed to fill him with awe, dread, excitement. Despite having come out of the duplicator, it wasn't alive. It didn't breathe or have bodily fluids. It wasn't composed of living cells. It wasn't composed of anything
in the sense of being constructed of smaller particles. It was one unit, indivisible, like some enormous quantum particle. I was experimenting with the duplicator. As he looked in at the thing, his voice was soft, respectful, like he was in a church. This came out.
"Oh my God,"
Melissa whispered. She covered her mouth, unable to take her eyes off the pitch-black sphere.
"What is it?"
"Now you see the reason for all the secrecy. If the feds get word of this, they'll seize the lab."
"What is it?"
That was the question, wasn't it? "We're pretty sure it's a singularity." Melissa gawked at him.
"You mean like a black hole?"
"Not exactly. Black holes are one form of singularity. You were conducting an experiment, and a black hole dropped out of your duplicator? From where?" "I'm not sure yet." "Did it come from outer space? Through time?" Peter put a hand on her shoulder. "You need to reread your Einstein. Space is time, more or less, even though you can only move forward in time." Melissa folded her skinny arms, bent one knee. "I didn't read my Einstein in the first place, as you well know." She stared at the singularity. "What sort of experiment were you conducting?" Peter shook his head. "It's better if you don't know. Safer for you. We haven't recorded a thing in case someone hacks our computers."
"Give me some sense of what you think happened. Is it dangerous?"
"Up to now, I thought of that portal as a simple loop, a wormhole that comes right back here a fraction of an instant earlier than our subjective time." Melissa pinched the bridge of her nose.
"Right, I got that.
But I was wrong, because if that were the case, this couldn't come out." He pointed at the singularity. "Because there couldn't be anything in the wormhole beyond what we send in."
"So what do you think now?"
"I think the duplicator is a portal backstage, to the beginning of things and the end, to the source." Peter closed his eyes. Images, impressions swirled. "But in the end, I don't really know." Staring in at the dark sphere, Melissa pressed a trembling hand over her mouth.
"It's too much, Peter. It's like you've summoned a god."
Two of the physicists, Jill Sanders and Natalia Komolov, passed, looking both exhausted and excited. Peter nodded. Despite being fairly good friends with Jill, Melissa didn't seem to recognize her. Peter put his arm around Melissa, coaxed her to turn away from the glass.
"Here's the important part. It contains a staggering amount of energy."
Peter raised his hands, fingers spread.
"I mean, a breathtaking, miraculous amount of energy.
We've been experimenting on it with lasers. It turns out the center is rotating. You wouldn't believe what we've been able to do." He pulled a black felt-tip pen and a notepad out of his shirt pocket, leaned the notepad against the glass, and sketched a circle. "This is the singularity." He added an ellipse around the circle. "This is the transition region surrounding it." He drew a series of dots entering the transition region. "We sent a stream of nanobots into the transition region, designed to break into two parts." He drew a line of smaller dots, dropping into the circle, another line continuing out of the transition region. "One part falls into the singularity, the other comes back out." He looked at Melissa, aware that he was speaking way too quickly, but unable to slow down. "The part that comes out contains more energy than the entire nanobot that went in." Melissa nodded.
"You're saying you can use it as an energy source?"
Peter nodded.
"It contains enough energy to power the entire world for a decade, just this one. And we don't have to settle for just one."
Melissa looked at him.
"What do you mean?"
"If we want another, we can repeat the experiment. Create another paradox." Melissa stared in at the thing, biting her lower lip.
"No more oil or coal or nuclear to fight over," she whispered. "They could run everything. We could end the war in a day."
He was in possession of an inexhaustible, carbon-neutral supply of energy. His duplicator was, as Kathleen had pointed out, an inexhaustible supply of food. Between the two, so much would change.
sent it back, Melissa whispered.
What?
I've never seen anything that scared me so badly. You know I can't. If I put it back in the duplicator, it'll come right back out and it might bring a friend.
I know.
Melissa couldn't take her eyes off it. How would you use it to supply the world with energy? Are you going to run power lines from the lab door out to India? Maybe hand out free singularities to Russia and North Korea? Peter smiled.
Far-field wireless power transfer. It's been around for a decade. We aim beams of electromagnetic radiation at fuel cells set on platforms. Anyone from any nation will be free to tap the fuel cells and help themselves to as much power as they want.
He raised a finger. As long as they agree to an immediate ceasefire and come to the table to negotiate an end to the war. If any country balks, no free power. They're cut off for some predetermined amount of time.
Tentatively, as if expecting a shock, Melissa touched her finger to the glass. The war would become moot in any case, Peter said. It would be like fighting over seawater or oxygen.
You think you can do it?
I know I can. But I'm going to need billions, quiet billions. I'll hire engineers to design the fuel cells and platforms without telling them what they're for.
He took a swig of Zing. He felt exhausted, shaky, slightly headachy, like he might be coming down with something.
Catherine is going to help me raise money through her connections.
Melissa stepped away from the isolation chamber.
Maybe I can help her.
I'm barely able to work as it is now, anyway.
Peter gave her a big hug. Thank you. Thank you for believing in me. I don't know what I'd do without you.
Chapter 23. Fowler dreamed 1,000 people were charging at him with axes and shovels. He was holding a gun. He lifted it, but instead of aiming at the mob storming at him, which was now led by Moonlark, clutching a machete, he pointed the gun at his own temple and fired. He woke with a jolt, which startled Storm and woke her as well, because their wrists were lashed together.
Sorry, I had a nightmare.
The grogginess in Storm's eyes vanished, as if she'd been slapped. Fowler didn't understand her reaction, then realized she wasn't looking at him, she was looking past him. He turned. In the distance, a world the size of his fist hung partially obscured by clouds in an evening sky.
Ah! Grinning, he looked back at Storm. I told you, didn't I?
They were lucky she'd spotted it.
It's too far away.
She stared at the world, seemed unable to take her eyes off it.
We're going to fall past it.
Fowler twisted to appraise the distance. It was indeed far away, but it was also far below. Worth a try. They'd been falling for over 2 days. He'd rather not have to fall that long or longer before chancing upon another.
Hold on to my feet.
He shifted onto his stomach to get the full force of the wind. Once Storm had a grip on his ankles, he spread his arms and legs and began to glide. Maybe it was an illusion, but it felt like their horizontal movement was remarkably swift. Maybe two bodies created more pressure on the wind.
It was dark by the time they made it over, and the world below was nothing but an ever-growing starless patch of black in the sky.
This is perfect, Fowler said. No one will see us land. We can parachute into a quiet part of the city and blend in.
He could barely contain his excitement at the thought of seeing another world. The darkness blanketing it added a sense of mystery of diving headfirst into the unknown. Soon, there were no stars at all visible in the blackness underfoot. Fowler fumbled with the harness, cinching the buckles so their bodies were squeezed together face to face, her body pressed tight against his. It was unsettling to fall toward a world in darkness. It was impossible to know how close they were to the ground, but if Fowler deployed the parachute too soon, they might drift right past the world. Finally, he spotted a pinprick of orange light, then another. Fires. The reflected moon and starlight began to reveal more detail, vast fields and forests separated by strips that he guessed were roads. They were more than close enough to deploy the chute.
Get ready for a jolt. Wrap your arms around your head. Try to keep your neck from snapping too violently, and your head from colliding with mine.
Storm did as he instructed, her elbow pressed against his ear.
Okay, on three. One, two.
He glanced down one last time, saw the ground fast approaching. Three! Storm let out a clipped shriek as the parachute snaked out and opened in one fluid motion. As he and Storm were crushed together, it was like being squeezed by a giant hand. His vision went spotty. Then they were drifting serenely under the stars, a new world below. Fowler could make out smallish buildings spread here and there, with a concentrated cluster along one edge. The dark corner of his mind that housed the words grudgingly offered up town.
It's like a picture in a book.
Storm's tone was somewhere between fear and wonder. A cool breeze blew them in the general direction of the town. A cylindrical building, a silo, passed below. The word sent a chill of pleasure through Fowler. I think all the pictures and books are real places, he said. Storm looked at him like he was nuts.
Have you seen a picture of an ocean? It would take up the whole sky.
That was true. There were also pictures of mountain ranges that went on and on until they disappeared in the distance. The world wasn't made to hold things that big. Only an artist's imagination could hold them. They were dropping toward a forest, which wouldn't do at all, so Fowler spread his arms and coaxed them toward a weedy field. A hard breeze pulled them on a swift horizontal.
Don't try to land on your feet, Fowler said. Just topple over as soon as we touch ground.
Weeds snapped against their shoes, then whipped their legs. Storm squealed as they hit solid ground and fell, tumbling in a heap. Fowler undid the clasps, lashing them together, then stood, brushed himself off. The night was wonderfully silent, save for the chirp of crickets. Nearby, the parachute deflated. There was a house on the edge of the field, partially enveloped in vines with big teardrop-shaped green leaves. He pointed to it. Why don't we rest in there until morning?
We've had plenty of time to sleep. Let's look around.
Fowler had assumed that, as the person with the most experience falling onto unknown worlds, he'd be calling the shots. I'm not sure it makes much sense to stumble around in the dark.
Well, I don't care. I'm going to look around. If you want to hide out until morning, go ahead.
Fowler was tempted to take out the photograph to remind himself that the two of them couldn't look happy together, but it was too dark for him to see it in any case, so instead he trailed Storm along a dirt path, skirting the edge of the field, past a truck rusting beneath a blanket of vines, then some big piece of machinery rusting next to the truck. They found a wider dirt road that led through the woods, away from the house. Every so often they passed houses, most of them small and seemingly constructed as a single piece, like they came out of a mold. None appeared occupied. The woods opened up, giving way to fields. They passed the silo and barn Fowler had spotted from above, next to a big house with a long porch wrapped around it. The scene was beautiful. Together, the trio of structures created a balance, a harmony he couldn't put into words.
Are you crying? Storm asked.
Fowler wiped the back of his hand across one cheek. He came away damp.
Why are you crying?
Fowler shrugged.
I don't know. It's just seeing that farm. It gives me this warm feeling, and I feel like I should know why, but I don't.
Storm studied the scene.
But you've seen pictures of farms before, haven't you?
It's not the same. Storm studied the farm for a moment longer, then pushed on. The horizon was turning pink with the dawn when the dirt road intersected a paved road. They took the paved road toward the town. Chapter 24. The town lay at the bottom of a long, sloping hill. The buildings on one side of the main street hung right over the edge, some reinforced by steel beams sunk into the side of the world. Houses were sprinkled haphazardly around the rest of the small valley. Maybe we should stroll down the main street of the town as casual as can be, Fowler said. See what we can see. Avoid talking to anyone until we learn how to blend in. Storm gave him a bemused look.
No one saw us land. Who's going to suspect we dropped here from another world?
For Fowler, the memory of a man standing over him clutching a half brick was still fresh.
Just humor me, okay?
Storm shrugged, then set off down the hill. They passed a woman sitting on a porch, doing absolutely nothing. Fowler waved. She squinted, partially raised her hand, and gave a tentative flip of her fingers. A few doors down, a small pug-nosed dog rushed out from between two pickup trucks. It pulled up short at the curb and began barking, its butt popping into the air with each bark. All of the dogs on Fowler's world had been eaten within 100 days. Fowler guessed this world must have more food. Fowler knelt on one knee and held out two fingers, but the dog was not to be won over, so they moved on. The main drag was just ahead. It was barely 2 blocks long, the curbs spotted with vehicles. A half dozen people were visible. There was a man sitting in a wooden chair set out on the sidewalk while another cut his hair. Another man was hammering something, half in, half out of a doorway. A couple were crossing the street, and 2 young girls were drawing something on the sidewalk with a stone. Stores lined the street, the snugness making Fowler feel comforted. He hadn't realized how peculiar open spaces made him feel. Not a bad feeling, just untethered, as if he might fall up into the sky at any moment. The stores to the left and right were empty, their display windows mostly broken and displaying nothing but dust and dead moths.
"We should be talking," Storm said. "People usually talk when they're walking together."
"Good point." They passed a store that wasn't empty. There looked to be food inside, along with some day one things, shoes and such. Fowler was tempted to stop and take a closer look, but stuck to his plan. There would be plenty of time later.
"Did I seem at all familiar when you first saw me?" Fowler asked. "Like maybe we'd met before, but you couldn't remember where?"
"No.
I heard someone had brought in a lunatic who claimed he fell out of the sky. I didn't want you to get too close in case you were dangerous."
Fowler laughed. "You may get a chance to see how it feels to tell someone you fell out of the sky." Ahead, 2 men stepped out of a doorway onto the street. Fowler's heart thumped slow and hard as the men turned in their direction. This was it, their first test. They were older men, 1 wearing a leather-billed cap, both in heavy boots held together with masking tape. The men slowed as they approached, then stopped completely. They were gawking at Fowler.
"Who are you?"
A walrus mustache hid the movement of the man's lips, but he didn't have a beard. His face looked strange, sporting so much bare skin.
"Excuse me?"
Fowler said, trying to sound light and unconcerned.
"I've never seen you before."
He said it like it was a shocking thing, looked at his companion, who shook his head slowly as if in a trance. Fowler held out a hand.
"The name's Fowler. I'm from..."
He jerked his thumb over his shoulder.
"Off in the far reaches."
The men stared at Fowler like he had the head of a goat. Fowler wondered why they weren't staring at Storm. Certainly she was more stare-worthy than he. The man with the big mustache finally looked at Storm.
"Emily, who is this?"
He squinted at Storm.
"Or is it Susanna?"
"Stuart?" the other man called, looking past Fowler. Fowler glanced over his shoulder. A tall man with a bland face, partially obscured by a scraggly blonde beard, was heading toward them. This wasn't going according to plan. Both men pointed at Fowler.
"Look at him,"
the mustached man said.
"I've never seen him before in my life."
Stuart stepped onto the sidewalk, his head tilted as if trying to make sense of Fowler's face.
"We keep to ourselves," Fowler stammered. "We're hermits."
"It's like he appeared out of thin air,"
the mustached man said to Stuart. 2 women were crossing the street, their curiosity evidently piqued by the growing crowd. Fowler lifted his head to greet them, trying to keep up the air of, "Oh, isn't this a silly misunderstanding?" When he saw the women's faces, his polite smile crumpled. They were staring wide-eyed at Storm, approaching her as one might approach a wild dog on a lead of indeterminate length. They were wearing blue summer dresses, worn but clean, and each had a yellow bow in her hair. They both looked exactly like Storm. One by one, the men who'd been staring at Fowler noticed these 2 storms and their eyes widened further as they looked from Storm to these women and back again.
"What the hell is going on?" Stewart finally asked.
He looked at the two women.
"Emily! Susanna!"
The two women nodded, their eyes not leaving Storm. Storm looked like she might collapse. Stewart turned to Storm.
"Then who are you? What's going on?"
He sounded on the verge of panic. Two others joined the crowd, yet more hurried toward them, so much for blending in.
"Look," Fowler said,
then fell silent. He wasn't sure how to continue. There was no remotely feasible lie he could tell. It hadn't occurred to him that a world could be small enough that everyone knew everyone else by name. His only recourse seemed to be to tell the truth. "I can tell you who we are and how we got here, but you're not going to believe me. I wouldn't believe me if I were you." Fowler heard a shout in the distance. There were at least a dozen people crowded around now. Some looked as if they weren't breathing for fear they might miss a word. Fowler pointed at the sky. "There are other worlds far above here, so far above you can't even see them." He took a deep breath and pressed on. "Storm and I fell from one of them." The silence stretched on so long that Fowler felt himself turning red with embarrassment, as if he'd just been caught telling an absurd lie. Finally, Stewart asked,
"Are you trying to tell us you fell out of the sky?"
"I'm not trying to tell you anything," Fowler said. "We fell out of the sky." "Well," he shrugged the pack off his back, opened the pouch, and pulled out the parachute. "Not exactly fell, we parachuted out of the sky. Obviously, if we fell, we'd have been killed. We parachuted." He partly unfolded the parachute, showed it to them. "It captures air so you float down slowly." He looked at Storm, hoping for some support, but she was gaping at her duplicates, her mouth working soundlessly.
"Mister, you're so full of shit I can smell it from here," Stewart said.
Fowler could feel his face growing redder, now out of anger. He took a step toward Stewart.
"If I'm lying, you explain it to me."
He dropped the parachute on the sidewalk.
"How else could we have gotten here? Why have you never seen us before? If I knew, I wouldn't be asking you, would I?"
Fowler opened his mouth to say that he'd prove it. He'd parachute off a building and show them, but none of the buildings were more than two stories tall. Not enough for the parachute to open. He turned his face to the sky and sighed in frustration.
"How is us falling from another world any harder to believe than what happened to all of us a few hundred days ago?"
"Hey," Stewart said, "that's enough."
"What? I'm just saying,"
Fowler pressed his hands to the sides of his head.
"If none of us knows anything about what happened before that day, assuming we even existed, I said that's enough out of you," Stewart snapped.
People were looking at each other as if Fowler had pulled out his pecker. Stewart gestured toward two young, rather large men at the back of the crowd.
"Jim, Billy, help me lock these two up. We'll sort this out after we can gather the city council."
Stewart grabbed Fowler by the shoulder. Fowler tried to shake his hand off.
"Why would you lock us up? We haven't done anything wrong."
"You're spreading bad feelings," James said,
as if that explained everything. Chapter 12. At the far end of the driving range, a figure squatted to tee up a ball. From this distance, Peter couldn't make out his face, but the Panama hat told him it was Ugo. He took a deep breath and, box of chocolates under his arm, headed across the parking lot toward the driving range. The yardage markers set on the range were still standing, but the grass was knee-high and choked with weeds. Too much energy was needed to maintain the range and adjoining miniature golf course. Plus, who but Ugo went to a driving range in the middle of a world war? Ugo wound, whacked a ball on a low, rising trajectory out past the 250-yard marker. As he turned to pluck another ball from a bucket, he noticed Peter and froze for a moment, staring, before setting another ball on the tee. Peter had tried playing golf with Ugo once, back when they were friends, and had quickly realized it wasn't for him, too frustrating. He squinted against the glare coming off the blacktop, feeling yet another headache coming on, and shifted the box of chocolates to his other arm. It was a good thing it was a cool day, or they'd be melting. Ugo was wearing a white polo shirt, his hat, and wraparound sunglasses. Peter raised a hand in greeting, Ugo only stared. He didn't look surprised to see Peter.
I still don't get what you see in this game, Peter said.
No, you wouldn't.
Peter stopped a dozen steps from Ugo.
I thought maybe we could talk.
Gripping the club, Ugo looked down at the ball.
Is that right?
Ugo, I'm sorry. I want to make things right between us, but I don't know how.
Ugo glanced at him in what seemed a warning, then he looked away as if he found it hard to look at Peter for long. Peter pushed on.
I loved Isabella. I never would have done anything I thought would harm her. I only wanted to help her.
Ugo stared off at the field.
What do you have there?
Peter offered the box to Ugo. To his surprise, Ugo took them. He examined the box.
Knipschild truffles. These must have been hard to find.
I just want you to know how sincerely sorry I am.
Nothing says sincerity like Knipschild truffles.
Ugo pushed the club he was holding into his bag, pulled out his driver. Peter took an involuntary half-step backward as Ugo turned, the club clutched in his fist. He strode to the tee, the chocolates in one hand, driver in the other.
You're so transparent, like a little boy. You want to repair things with me because you can't explain our falling out to Melissa. And goodness knows you can't tell her the truth.
Ugo set the box in the grass, plucked out one of the truffles, and set it on a tee.
I'm not particularly interested in helping you out of that little jam.
The truffle exploded when Ugo hit it, spraying chocolate a dozen feet in front of the tee. Ugo swatted, retrieved another, and teed it up.
I'm here because you're my friend, or were, because we're family.
He wondered if Ugo had surmised that Melissa was the one who told Peter where to find Ugo. Come back to the lab. Let's get back to work. The war is too important to let a personal conflict get in the way.
A personal conflict?
Ugo swung the club viciously, as if trying to bludgeon the truffle out of existence. Chocolate filling spattered his golf shoes. He paused, turned toward Peter.
What a nice, sanitary way to phrase it.
Ugo stuck out his bottom lip, surveyed the range.
When I was a 12-year-old boy, a prisoner in the Omarska camp during the war, I was forced to bite off a fellow inmate's pinky finger while the guards cheered. If I'd refused, the other boy would have bitten off my pinky.
Peter put his hand over his mouth.
Jesus, Ugo.
I had no idea. Without warning, Ugo swung the driver at the box, sent it spinning toward Peter, one side torn open, truffles bouncing the grass.
I don't want your sympathy. I want you to understand. You think I'm of no consequence. A lightweight.
Peter opened his mouth to disagree, but could see from Ugo's eyes that he'd probably swing the driver at Peter's head if he interrupted again. Ugo gave a quick shrug.
Ugo doesn't agree with this, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to send his wife through my duplicator. Who cares what Ugo thinks?
Ugo rubbed his long nose.
Don't be a dick, you once said to me, in front of the janitor.
He shoved the driver into the bag.
I'm not who you evidently think I am. I'm not weak. When people cross me, I take their heads off.
He spat in the grass. Peter surveyed the chocolate massacre stretching from the tee box down the gentle slope into the weeds.
This didn't go down at all like you're thinking. Isabella pleaded with me.
Ugo stabbed a finger at him.
If you speak her name again, I'll split your skull against that wall.
Peter was tempted to tell Ugo to go ahead and try, but win or lose, a fight would only make things worse.
Now, Ugo said, as to the war, it is too important. Too important to waste time helping you play with your toys. And too important to be left to a frail little dove of a president who doesn't have the stomach to do what has to be done.
What do you mean?
Ugo turned away. You'll find out. Now get out of my sight.
Peter stood his ground as Ugo moved to a new, cleaner tee and went back to hitting golf balls. After a minute or two, he headed back across the parking lot. The war was too important to be left in the hands of President Aspen? Peter had no idea what that meant. The next election wasn't for another 2 years.
What?
Was Ugo planning a coup? Peter chuckled at the thought.
Chapter 25. They were led to a cell occupied by the most fearsome-looking man Fowler had ever seen. He was sprawled on the floor along the bars, one knee drawn up near his bare chest, which looked like two flat stones set beside each other. He had long jet-black hair, reddish-brown skin, and ragged, almost gaudy scars on both his shoulder and stomach. He barely glanced at Fowler and Storm as they took a seat on the long bench across from him. There was a puddle in the corner of the cell. From the dusky stink, Fowler guessed it was urine. "That went well," Fowler said,